Hi, this is Emma Sutherland. Join us on FX Medicine next week, where I'll be talking to Dr. Will Bulsiewicz about the gut terrain, host defense, and how to think outside the box when working with patients on their gut health. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode. Hi, and welcome to FX Medicine, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. FX Medicine acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. With us today is Matt Douglas. Matt is a qualified naturopath who graduated from the Australian College of Natural Medicine in 2004, and he has held diverse roles in the natural health industry for the past 20 years. He is the owner of the Digestive Wellness Clinic, a clinic focused on treating complex gut disorders. Matt utilizes functional testing to gain better insight into the root cause of a patient's gut symptoms. Then, drawing on the principles of naturopathic medicine, he prescribes a personalized treatment protocol, which is aimed at correcting the underlying imbalances and restoring digestive function. Matt has extensive experience treating small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is what we're going to be discussing today. Welcome to FX Medicine, Matt. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Now, the actual prevalence of SIBO is vastly unknown. Some studies say 5% of the population, others say 15%. And SIBO is often seen in conjunction with irritable bowel syndrome. A recent study on IBS patients showed that SIBO rates were 7 times higher in IBS sufferers. But shockingly, hydrogen levels were inversely correlated with quality of life scores, but directly correlated to anxiety and depression scores. So to me, this really highlights the fact that SIBO is deeply impactful. And I'm not sure about you, but I am almost fearful of treating SIBO. It is so highly complex. You know, the validity of testing, the super restrictive and horrendous diets, the high relapse rate. It just feels so challenging and confusing to me. So today, Matt, I really want to pick your brains on how to treat SIBO in a way that is as easy as possible for both us, the practitioner, and the patient.
So definitely, you know, with my IBS patients, I'm seeing SIBO, you know, at least half, 50, 70% of the time. Mm. So it's super common and a super common cause of IBS type symptoms. So in my cohort, definitely the prevalence I see is pretty high.
Yeah. I mean, what exactly is the definition of SIBO and what symptoms are often seen as a result?
So it's simply put, it's just an increase in the normal amount of bacteria that you find in the small intestine. Mm-hmm. So there's always some bacteria in the small intestine. So the duodenum has about 10 to 1,000 CFU per mil. The jejunum, about 100 to 1,000. Mm-hmm. Proximal ileum, 1,000 to 10,000. And then the terminal ileum, up to 10 million.
Okay.
So anything above that within those regions, we would count as SIBO.
Okay.
So the primary role of bacteria in the small intestine is to break down simple carbohydrates by fermenting them. And when they do that, there's going to be byproducts of that process. So gases, amines, short-chain fatty acids, endotoxins. Mm-hmm. And in the normal small intestine, we can handle those byproducts. So we're designed to handle those things. But in SIBO, when you get an excess of bacteria, you're going to get an excess of those metabolites, and that can cause symptoms. So you're seeing abdominal pain, bloating, distension, constipation, diarrhea, nausea, belching, reflux, heartburn. So just your classic IBS symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But in some people, you can also see systemic symptoms.
Okay.
So fatigue, brain fog, skin issues, restless legs, joint pain.
Mm. And are there classic subtypes of SIBO? How do we break that down?
Yeah, so there's three gases that you measure which indicate which bacteria are overgrown. So there's some bacteria produce hydrogen gas, others hydrogen sulfide, and then you've got methane gas. And all these can be measured on a breath test.
Okay.
Methane, technically not a bacteria, it's an archaea. So technically it's not termed SIBO, it's called intestinal methanogen overgrowth, and we find elevated methane gas.
Mm-hmm. Well, over the course of this conversation, I want to challenge our current understanding and thinking of SIBO, because my initial impression is that SIBO is usually caused by a retrograde translocation of bacteria or a poor migrating motor complex function. But maybe that's too simplistic. Before we go any further, I just want to point out that SIBO is a secondary phenomenon. So, Matt, what other mechanisms are at play with SIBO?
Yeah, so our small intestine has ways to keep a lid on bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty dynamic system. So it's fast moving, it's highly oxygenated, it's acidic, so it's not very hospitable for bacteria.
Mm.
And all those defensive mechanisms we have will keep a lid on bacteria and prevent any overgrowth. So there's a few of those. So you got the motility of the small intestine, so the movement, so that's just your general peristalsis plus the migrating motor complex.
Mm-hmm.
Your digestive secretions, so that's stomach acid, pancreatic enzymes, bile.
Mm-hmm.
They're all bacteriostatic, so they help keep a lid. And then you've got your gut immunity, so secretory IgA, defensins, antimicrobial peptides that are all secreted along the lining of the small intestine.
Okay.
So all those things together will keep a lid on any overgrowth. That is keep everything in homeostasis. So typically with SIBO, when SIBO develops, one or more of those defensive mechanisms has faltered or isn't working well, and that creates the environment for bacteria to grow. And it's typically the normal bacteria in the small intestine. So it used to be thought that it was colonic bacteria migrating up into the small intestine, but they're finding it's more the bacteria that's already there, residing there, that's become overgrown and dysbiotic as well. So it's growing in different rates.
Mm. And I really want to kind of just lean into that for a minute, that misconception that SIBO is a result of the anaerobic colonic flora that's migrated. And I want to explore the concept of separate microbiomes within the small intestine, because I find it fascinating. I read one paper that described SIBO as a disorder characterized by differences in quantity, quality, and location of the small intestine microbiota. Can you talk us through the function of each section and the research in this space?
Yeah, so with the microbiome, I guess we all kind of imagine it's the large intestine microbiome. It's the thing we think of when we think of the gut microbiome. But the whole digestive tract is this one long microbiome. So your mouth has a microbiome, the esophagus, the stomach, both have microbiomes. And then the three sections of the small intestine each have is similar but unique microbiomes. So the duodenum, the jejunum, the ileum all have different kind of bacteria growing in them. And it's to do with just the gradient. So as you move through the small intestine at the top and the duodenum, it's more oxygenated, it's more acidic. And then as you move down into the terminal ileum, things become less oxygenated, less acidic. So the bacteria populations will change as you move through. So the duodenum, the site where, you know, most chemical digestion is going on, so there's a lot of bile, a lot of pancreatic enzymes in that space. And the dominant phyla, and this is true throughout the small intestine, the Firmicutes, the actinobacteria, the proteobacteria.
Mm-hmm.
But then the species within those will kind of differ as we move through. So in the duodenums, Lactobacillus, Streptococcus, Veillonella, E. coli, Klebsiella, you'll see. The jejunum, similar, but you'll see a bit more Prevotella, Fusobacterium, and again, E. coli, Klebsiella.
Okay.
Proximally similar to the jejunum, but just more bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the terminal ileum, it's getting closer to colonic bacteria. So more Clostridium, Bacteroides, coliforms. So it really changes. In the terminal ileum, where we're kind of moving into the cecum and more aerobic bacteria kind of showing up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that comes back to your question about the translocation. So most of the colonic bacteria are aerobes, so they like oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just not going to like the environment of the small intestine. And Pimentel and his analysis of the jejunum in SIBO patients, he wasn't picking up any colonic bacteria, which kind of makes sense. They're just not going to like that environment. So, you know, it's possible down that lower ileum you can get more of the colonic bacteria, but they're not going to migrate super high up into the small intestine.
Mm. I think that's really interesting because that's just how we think about it. But it's almost four different, well, they merge into each other, but different microbiomes in there. And we've really got to think about that from a testing perspective as well. But just to press pause for a minute, before we go any further, differential diagnosis with SIBO, like what should we be aware of? Because perhaps we need to be referring or perhaps it's not SIBO. What are other things we need to keep in our head?
Yeah, so you want to look definitely celiac, Crohn's potentially. Mm-hmm. You want to rule out. You know, you can see it in hypothyroidism, diabetes as well.
Mm.
But primarily, they'll be the big ones, Crohn's and celiac would be the good ones to rule out, number one.
Mm, okay. So let's move on to diagnosis because the gold standard for a positive diagnosis of SIBO is, as you mentioned, a jejunal aspirate culture. But that's not exactly easy. It requires an endoscopy. It's really expensive and it's not easy to access. And we tend to use breath tests instead. So what's considered positive test result for SIBO on a breath test?
So for hydrogen, it's a rise of 20 from the lowest point to the highest point within 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Methane's a little different. So technically we're looking, it's more intestinal methanogen overgrowth, so we're looking for elevation of methane. And that can be 10 or above at any point throughout the test, especially if they're constipated.
Right. Okay.
So the methane picture, typically, not always, but typically they're going to be more constipated. So anything above 10 throughout the test counts as intestinal methanogen overgrowth.
Okay.
Hydrogen sulfide is the other one. We don't have access to that test yet in Australia. So that's a tricky one for us to diagnose. There was, you know, an old way of looking at it was if you saw a flat line on the breath test, maybe that indicates hydrogen sulfide. I don't think that's ever been validated, but that was the old way of looking at it. That's pretty rare that I see that, though. So I'm not sure about that one.
Mm, how prevalent it is. I mean, let's just deep dive for a minute into the vortex of testing and the pros and cons of the breath testing. In 2017, the North American consensus was developed that aimed to standardize breath testing for SIBO. In 2022, researchers compared the previous testing guidelines to the North American consensus guidelines, and they did a study and they had lots of different groups in this study, and it's all quite complex. Even for me reading it, I got confused. But essentially, Matt, what I want to know is with the testing, do we do what length test, what substrate, what do you find clinically relevant?
Yeah, so number one, always measure hydrogen and methane. There's some labs that will just measure hydrogen.
Okay.
They're still around. So, yeah, always hydrogen and methane. Hopefully, eventually, we get to do hydrogen sulfide as well in Australia. And then you want to do a three-hour test. So you want to see, you want to make sure it's getting into the colon. And then for me, and the North American consensus is lactulose is the better substrate. So it's non-absorbed, so it's going to pass all the way through the intestines versus glucose, which is much faster absorbing, so potentially it's not getting all the way through the small intestine.
Mm, okay, interesting. Mm. So using the substrate lactulose, doing a 3-hour test and measuring hydrogen and methane is the way to go.
Yeah, and there's also fructose as well, I should say. There's another substrate
okay.
you can use. But for me, it's lactulose.
Okay.
It's the best studied.
Okay. It's also, I've done the SIBO test myself quite a few times. I think we're all our best guinea pig. It is a little confusing. It's a tricky test to do. So I just want to make sure I get the right test to my patients rather than having to redo it at any point later on.
Yeah. It's, and, you know, there are some issues or some question marks on the testing. So the one was always, are you just measuring with lactulose, or are you just measuring transit time through the gut? And if someone has a faster transit time through the small intestine, the gases are going to show up as, once it hits the colon, there's a lot of fermentation going on. So there's a lot of gas production. So if that's hitting the colon prior to 90 minutes, then that's going to show an elevated gas, which is a false positive.
Right. So if you do have somebody with a fast transit time, will you tweak the test, or do you still do the test as is? What's your workaround?
Well, yeah, it's super tricky because it's hard to know. And then the flip side is also slow transit time. Mm. So if someone has gastroparesis, for example, you can get a false negative because it's moving so slowly. Super tricky. So, symptoms are always your best barometer in that case. So, it's really tricky with the fast transit. But for me, again, I think that would be rare. So typically, if you suspect SIBO and you're seeing those symptoms, the bloating, the abdominal pain, it's quite often showing up.
Okay. So 3-hour test, lactulose substrate, hydrogen and methane correlate with symptoms. But I'm curious, are there any patterns in bloods that you look out for to point the picture towards SIBO?
Yeah, so there's a few things. They're all obviously indirect markers and more to do with absorption. So definitely ferritin, iron studies for sure. So you can see low iron with SIBO, B12 is a big one. As well, zinc.
Okay.
D3 I'll look at as well. So definitely the fat soluble vitamins can be an issue. And, D3 is just so important for everything, but for gut health as well. White blood cells, protein as well is the other one. So you can definitely see in malabsorption, low protein, even low stomach acid sometimes that'll show up as low protein. Thyroid's good to check, TSH, and the doctor's willing better thyroid makeup if it's indicated. And then gluten serology, that's an important one. You just want to rule out celiac. And then the inflammation markers, so CRP, ESR as well.
Okay. So there's a general pattern that we could see in bloods that, it's all that malabsorption picture.
More malabsorption, nutrient deficiencies.
Yeah. But what about microbiome assessments? Are there any markers that you see on those that you think, maybe that mechanism's at play?
Yeah, I look at the digestive markers in association with SIBO, looking more at the digestive markers. So calprotectin, number one. So obviously if that's super high, then it may indicate inflammatory bowel disease and it's worth getting checked out, get a scope.
Yeah.
Pancreatic elastase is the other one I really like. So obviously if your pancreatic elastase is low, below 200, then you're not producing enough pancreatic enzymes. And obviously you're not going to be breaking down your food as well, number one, but it's also you're going to be losing that bacteriostatic effect of pancreatic enzymes. So that's a really important one. You can also test secretory IgA on the stool. Bit of conjecture about the validity of that one. Zonulin's there as well. So zonulin can be a marker for leaky gut, damage to the gut lining. And then there's steatorrhea as well, so fat in the stool. So that can give you some indicators. So it can be quite common in SIBO because our bacteria in the small intestine are going to deconjugate bile acids, and typically they're going to do that lower in the small intestine.
Okay.
If you've got overgrowth higher up, then that deconjugation can happen sooner than it should, and that can affect your fat digestion and fat absorption. So if we're picking up fat in the stool, that can be an indirect marker of SIBO potentially. If SIBO is clear and you're finding fat, then maybe it's to do with bile production.
Okay. There's lots of things to look out for, but I love this building a picture of what all these things could look like that are pointing in that right direction.
Yeah, so it's all about building a case, you know, and collecting evidence.
Yeah. Okay, let's shift gears into the beast, which is treatment. Before we get into the weeds, though, can you go through your treatment goals first and what underlying mechanisms you're addressing with them?
Yeah, so always starting with the good old naturopathic principles.
Mm-hmm.
So treat the patient, not the disease. Treat holistically and look for the root cause.
Mm.
So that's always number one. That's always the framework. Then treatment kind of depends on which gases are elevated. So hydrogen versus methane, mm-hmm. number one. But with SIBO, you're looking, you know, at the whole small intestine. So the small intestine in normal healthy people or people without SIBO, there's a normal homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
So you're producing enough digestive secretions, things are moving well throughout. So with SIBO, we know one of those mechanisms is deficient. So it's really kind of digging in and figuring out what may have disrupted the small intestinal bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot there. So you want to look, number one, if anything's impeding movement through the small intestine.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be physical, so physical obstruction, so blind loops, diverticulosis,
mm-hmm.
Surgical adhesions, even and endometriosis as well.
Okay.
So that's tricky, that one. Then there's certain organic diseases, so diabetes, scleroderma, other autoimmune conditions as well can affect. Especially the nerve propulsion of the small intestine.
Okay.
And then food poisoning is a big one as far as the damage to the migrating motor complex. So the migrating motor complex is super important part of the picture,
mm-hmm.
With the small intestine. So that's the flushing of the small intestine. So it's a smooth muscle contraction that ripples through the stomach and small intestine between meals. So it happens in a fasted state and it's every hour and a half to 2 hours. It'll come through and it flushes food and bacteria and debris out of the small intestine into the large intestine. So it's super important mechanism for keeping a lid on bacterial overgrowth and just keeping things moving through the small intestine. So anything that damages that can lead to the growth of bacteria. And from my experience, the most common would be a food poisoning event.
Definitely.
So when you get a food poisoning bug, Campylobacter, Shigella, E. coli, whatever it may be, we'll create antibodies against that one. And then in some people, there's an autoimmune response where there's a bit of molecular mimicry going on where you also produce antivinculin antibodies, which is a protein that lives on the interstitial cells of Kajal on the small intestine.
Okay.
And they act like interstitial cells of Kajal, they act like a pacemaker. So they're the nerve, will kick off that nerve propulsion and kicks off the MMC. So super common that you'll see someone will go to Bali, they get food poisoning, they come home and within a few months they're kind of developing bloating, diarrhea, all these IBS symptoms. So that's a super common finding, and then that's the MMC. So that's the motility side. So you really got to dig into case histories and obviously any presenting conditions as well, which may impede that motility.
Mm-hmm.
Digestive secretions, that one's a bit tricky, but you can obviously do the pancreatic elastase. That'll let you know if you need to support the pancreatic enzymes.
Yeah.
Stomach acid is a big one as well. Hyperchloridia, achloridia potentially. So also help keep a lid on bacteria. Mm-hmm. And it's quite common to see SIBO develop after Helicobacter. So that's a finding that they see quite a bit, and Helicobacter obviously suppresses stomach acid. And then on the pancreas side of things, you also see that's quite common in pancreatitis, cystic fibrosis, so the low, where you produce low pancreatic enzymes. Mm-hmm. And then with bile, you see it in people who have their gallbladders removed or have cirrhosis of the liver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because when I'm thinking about patients that come in to see me, and it's not uncommon for them to have at least one of those things that you've just put under that umbrella, under motility, the migrating motor complex, and digestive secretions. So it, I feel like it's, you know, low-hanging fruit for the development of SIBO often.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a short list. I mean, there's a bunch more, traumatic brain injury. There's a heap of things potentially, but yeah, you really got to pick it apart, because it's key to kind of correcting the overgrowth. So we tend to get a bit too focused on killing the bacteria when it's really about, you know, that dysfunction of the small intestine and shifting those things and just creating an environment where that bacteria can't overgrow.
Mm, exactly. It's all about the terrain, right?
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, really, you know, taking a good case, super important, and just really trying to figure out how or why it may have developed. Sometimes you don't know. Mm. A lot of the time, you know, if people, you know, there's no big food poisoning event, there's no conditions that they've got, so it can be really tricky to kind of figure out in those cases. Then you kind of just cover all your bases moving forward. So then you've got obviously to get the bacterial load down.
Mm.
And there's three ways to do that. So you've got your herbal antimicrobials, antibiotics, and the elemental diet.
Mm, wow. Well, we're going to cover all of those because I'm really keen to dive into specifics around those. You know, in relation to, should we start with antimicrobial herbs?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With these, what is the dose and timing of treatment? Because I feel that we're starting to get our head around this concept of the damage that can occur with our antimicrobial herbs and how we need to use them in a way that's safe and has minimal collateral damage. So, but we also want them to be effective. So where is the line here?
Yeah, it's a real balancing act. So you're right. You've got to be mindful that herbs can have a detrimental effect, especially on the large intestinal microbiome.
Mm.
So it's got to be judicious in their use. And it varies from gas to gas. So for hydrogen, you know, typically those species are going to respond more to oregano, berberine, those kinds of the primary herbs that we use for those. And then you've got more accessory herbs, so neem, pomegranate, cinnamon, black seed. There's a bunch of different ones mm-hmm. that we can use. For methanogens, it's, again, oregano works well. Also allicin from garlic.
Mm.
And then, again, you know, some of those what I call secondary or accessory herbs, pomegranate, neem, cinnamon, black seed, those kind of things, clove, thyme. There's a bunch of different ones.
Mm-hmm.
Dosages, berberine, about 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams per day.
Mm-hmm.
Oregano, up to, again, 200 milligrams three times a day.
Okay.
And then the allicin, need a bit more, so probably about 360 milligrams three times a day. But this will vary from patient to patient, so you just got to, you know, gauge where they're at, definitely. So die-off or herxheimer reactions are always something to look out for. So if you go in too hard, too fast with the herbs, then you can definitely provoke, you know, a herx reaction, which can be headaches, fatigue, itchy skin, nausea, diarrhea, you know, the list goes on and on. So you really just want to ease in with the herbs.
Yeah, I can tell you from personal experience, I self-treated, of course, with berberine at a very hefty dose and actually ended up in the A&E with this. My legs were covered in bruises and an insane itch. So I have a lot of respect for these antimicrobial herbs and being very careful with them. But do you dose them for how long? So they're the doses that you would use, you know, berberine 1 to 2 grams per day. But how long would you do that for?
Well, it depends how high the gases are. Usually that kind of gives you an idea of how severe or how bad the overgrowth may be, and that kind of dictates how long you may need to be on a course.
Okay.
But typically for most people, and it kind of depends if they respond well as well, you know, two to three months is a general guideline.
Yeah.
And typically I'll rotate the herbs as well. So I wouldn't go any longer than 4 weeks on oregano. I'd probably have 4 weeks off and then go again, especially with oregano.
Right.
That's definitely the strongest.
Yeah.
And then really you're just testing response. So especially that first month, you should see, you know, some shift in symptoms, just to let you know you're kind of on the right track with the herbs. So, you know, there's no magic protocol.
No, and then this is why I find it so tricky. But I like that, you know, the general guideline of 2 to 3 months, you rotate the herbs. You don't use them each one for longer than 4 weeks. Then looking within that first month for a good shift in symptoms, would you say a 30% shift in symptoms? Is there a percentage you can give us?
Well, not even. Okay. Sometimes just a little, you know, 10% even, just something to let you know you're kind of on the right track, moving in the right direction.
Yeah. Okay.
But, yeah, like I said, it's so variable from patient to patient what they're going to respond to.
Yeah, okay. This
so
is
that,
why...
That, first month, you're really just trying what the standard course would be for my hydrogen or methane, so berberine, oregano, allicin, and then just seeing how they respond.
Okay.
And for some people, it's zero.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's tough.
It is. And then, you change things up, and there's other options as well.
Well, actually, let's cover that, because from a medical model, we've got reasonable research on the use of an antibiotic called rifaximin at a dose of around 550 milligrams 3 times a day for 14 days. Now, one review showed an average of around 70% success rate, but then we have a noticeable relapse rate of around 45% by the 9 month post-treatment, which is often caused because the underlying drivers are not being addressed as well. But, you know, what are your thoughts on rifaximin? What are the pros and cons? I mean, obviously we can't prescribe it, but we can refer. But what are the pros and cons? What do we need to know here?
Yeah, I actually quite like rifaximin.
Okay.
So it's not your typical antibiotic. So it's mostly non-absorbed, so it's not a systemic antibiotic.
Mm-hmm.
It's bile activated, so it's very active in the small intestine.
Right.
And then there's studies showing it's actually a eubiotic in the large intestine, so it doesn't seem to affect the beneficial species in the large intestine. Some studies show it actually helps or improves lactobacillus and bifido.
Okay.
So it's a really interesting antibiotic. Maybe, some people call it a eubiotic. It can actually balance the bacteria in the gut. So it's really, I find it, you know, that's the only antibiotic that I would be comfortable with people using. And I've seen it work quite well. And it can definitely potentially speed the process up if it works. But that's on the downside with rifaximin, is that there's non-response, so people just won't do anything. It'll do zero.
Okay.
kind of thing. So it's probably, that 70% mark sounds about right.
Okay. So,
and then, getting a hold of it is, a whole new story.
Yeah, so, that is tricky. I agree. Yeah. At what point would you think in a case, right, we may need to refer for rifaximin treatment?
I always let everyone know the three options from the get-go. So I know I explain each one and the benefits and downside of each, and kind of let them decide in that respect.
Okay.
So that's always a starting point. But, if we're going a month, 2 months with herbs and not much is happening, then it might be worth exploring the rifaximin or the elemental.
Okay. All right. So out of the three, we've covered the herbs, we've covered the rifaximin. Let's move on to the elemental. You mentioned in our discussion before today a 2004 paper on the elemental diet had a really big impact on how you treat SIBO. But what is the goal of the elemental diet and how on earth is it actually done? And then how do you transition patients back to whole foods? Like, what is the purpose of it? How do you do it?
Yeah, so not a fun experience. The elemental, it's a tough sell.
Mm.
But so the elemental diet is just a powder that you mix in water every day. That's your meals. That's all you eat for 14 to 21 days. And they're made up of just separate amino acids for protein, MCT for fat, dextrose for carbohydrates, and then your vitamins and your minerals.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting all your macros and your micros just in a super absorbable form. So absorb it really high up in the small intestine.
Yeah.
And there's effectively no substrate left to feed the bacteria, and you'll starve them out or they'll begin to reduce.
Mm-hmm.
They've got nothing to feed on. So it's a super effective treatment. From my experience, definitely the most effective treatment there is.
Okay.
For SIBO. But that's not a pleasant few weeks.
Quite
unpleasant. Yeah. So especially the first few days, that's rough. So, and you'll get a few people dropping out, within 4 days.
Right.
Yeah. So, it's a tough grind. It's a real grind. Towards the end, it becomes more of a psychological grind. You miss food, flavor, texture, warmth, all that, eating with friends. So, it's definitely effective. It's definitely quick, but it's a tough couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing that by itself. You're not doing that with herbs or with rifaximin, or you're doing them at the same time?
The one worry is with elemental is if there's any fungal overgrowth or SIFO, potentially you could be feeding that. So I typically use herbs as well, and just some oregano, kind of one of those mixes, oregano, allicin, philodendron mix, just in a lower dose, just throughout the elemental to potentially mitigate for that, but also just help the process as well. And that's typically well tolerated.
Okay. So.
And then, at the end of the elemental, ideally you're retesting just to see if it's done, the job's done, because it can be really hard to pick up off symptoms with that, because it can take a few weeks for things to come back online. So usually I'll transition someone back through on a low FODMAP diet, just to ease them back in to foods for a couple of weeks, just to take it easy, and then back to their normal diet.
Okay.
You do find maybe they'll need some extra digestive supports if everything kind of down-regulates throughout the process, so you just got to wake them back up. So sometimes they'll still be getting bloated, they'll still be getting symptoms for that reason, and it can take a while for everything to come back online. So I'll often supplement with some digestive enzymes throughout that process, or whatever else may be indicated, and you start a prokinetic.
So talking about prokinetics, because that's something I did want to cover, what's in our toolkit as far as prokinetics go, and what do you use, what's the dose, what's the timing? I'm really curious here.
Yeah, so a prokinetic is designed to stimulate the migrating motor complex, keep things moving, especially overnight. So there's a few herbs. Iberogast works quite well.
Okay.
So 60 drops, about 30 to 60 minutes before bed. And that's a prokinetic dose versus a 20 drops before meals, kind of digestive support dose.
Mm-hmm.
Then ginger can be a really good prokinetic as well. Artichoke can work as prokinetic. And then 5-HTP as well can be used.
Okay. What kind of dose of the 5-HTP?
I think it's about 100 milligrams.
Okay, great.
Yeah, before bed. And then some people will need potentially pharmaceutical prokinetics. They tend to be with the people with known conditions of diabetes, scleroderma, et cetera. They may need more serious support potentially.
Yeah.
So low-dose erythromycin or prucalopride.
Okay. So once again, we need a good referral network when we're working with SIBO.
Definitely. There's just a spectrum with SIBO.
Mm-mm.
So some it's pretty minor, it's quick and easy, whereas others it can be super challenging, especially if they have a lot of kind of other conditions going on.
Yeah.
The other one with the MNC that's super important is meal spacing. This one's huge.
Okay.
So the migrating motor complex it works in a fasted state, so it's happening between meals. And it only works in a fasted state. So if there's food in your stomach, upper small intestine, it doesn't trigger because it doesn't want to flush out those nutrients.
Okay.
So ideally having a 4 to 5 hour break between meals with no food in between. So you can have water, black tea, black coffee, herbal teas, but no milks, no sweeteners, no food in that time frame. And then at least 3 hours from dinner to bed and at least 12 hours from dinner to breakfast.
Mm.
And that just allows the small intestine to keep moving, keep flushing, keep emptying.
It's actually interesting because when I think of most of my patients, they're all eating every 2 to 3 hours. There's something going in. So even that alone, I think, could make a big difference.
Yeah, and it does. You know, a lot of my patients say that's the game changer for them. It can be that simple. It does make a huge difference. So, super important. The other one is just mindful eating.
Yeah.
So, you know, eating a relaxed state, eating slowly, chewing well. Amazing amount of people who don't do that. They'll kind of shovel it in and keep working. But again, that one can make a big difference. Those two, meal spacing, mindful eating, are really low-hanging fruit. It can make a big difference.
And potentially that's something that you could do, you know, while you're, awaiting treatment or, you know, after the first appointment to just see if that starts shifting things alone. Like, that's so easy for patients to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that first few weeks you've got while you're waiting on test results and things like that, you can, try out things like that, simple stuff. Some bitters before meals, apple cider vinegar before meals.
Yes.
Digestive enzymes. So you can play around with those things, just try to get a bit more symptomatic relief. That's going to make the rest of the process easier if you can actually, you know, make a difference to their symptoms just through these simple changes.
And, you know, no matter what way you treat SIBO, it is arduous. So I feel if you can get some quick wins on the board with your patient, your compliance and your, sticking to your treatment plan is going to be a lot easier for the patient.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. If they're managing their symptoms throughout the process, then, they're going to stick with it. It's much, much easier.
For sure. Now, I really wanted to pick your brains. We've got a few last questions. I really love partially hydrolyzed guar gum, and the research is really interesting. I read one study of a 5 gram dose given alongside rifaximin, and this combination was more successful at eradicating SIBO than rifaximin alone. But I mean, do you use it? If you do, how? How do you think it's working? I just would love to get some insights here.
Yeah, I really like PHGG.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as far as prebodies go, I think it's the best tolerated. So you've got to be careful with SIBO with the prebiotics. So obviously prebiotics feed bacteria, and certain prebiotics can definitely aggravate SIBO. But typically PHGG is well, it's going to be well tolerated in most people. You still get some people reacting to it. but most people it'll sit well. So that's number one. It's kind of a gentle prebiotic. It's well tolerated.
Mm-hmm.
I use it more so just to help kind of protect the microbiome as we're doing all this killing in the large intestine. I find using that may help just feed the large intestine microbiome and you know, try to keep those populations up.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to tell if it's you know, improving the efficacy of the treatment or not. That's really tricky, hard to know.
Mm.
I think with Pimentel, from what I can gather, he's the guy that figured that out, did that study. He doesn't use it when he prescribed Rifaximin for whatever reason. So I'm not sure what that means, but I quite like it, the PHGG.
Mm, yeah, and I think we've just got so much evidence about the good things it does in relation to butyrate and short-chain fatty acids, and it's relatively easy to take and low cost. So I really like it for those reasons.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I typically will use Saccharomyces as well. Should mention that. So I think Saccharomyces, probiotic yeast, is really good as well alongside the SIBO treatment. So it's got its own kind of antimicrobial properties. It will compete with the bacteria. It can stimulate the immunity of the gut as well and also have that kind of protective effect on the large intestinal microbiome.
Mm.
And there was one study I found with it where they used it in patients with liver cirrhosis and SIBO.
Okay.
And they did that for a month. I think it was 250 twice a day. And they saw a normalization of breath test results, I mean, about 40-something percent of the patients, which is pretty good just with Saccharomyces.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
So I find that's a nice adjunct. And again, it's typically well tolerated.
Okay. So last question for you. In relation to relapse, how do we prevent it? Or I mean, obviously we need to be addressing the underlying drivers, but do you have a protocol for maintenance? I mean, I know some prakis focus on motility while others, you know, hydrochloric acid, but what are your go-tos to minimise the risk of relapse?
Yeah, so definitely meal spacing.
Okay.
That's a huge one, number one. A prokinetic, again, it's hard to know how long they need to be on a prokinetic.
Okay.
If it is someone with, you know, predisposing condition, then they may need to be on long-term, forever kind of thing. But for your garden variety IBS, I typically do a prokinetic, for about 3 months post-treatment.
Okay.
And then we just begin to taper them down on the dose and just make sure everything kind of sticks.
Okay.
And then from there, usually they're going to be okay. You want to make sure they continue the meal spacing. Stress management as well, I find, is a big one. So if someone goes through, you know, something really stressful, then you can see the SIBO come back then as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they get another food poisoning event, it can come back. So when they're traveling, again, Saccharomyces is really good, but sometimes I recommend that they'll take some antimicrobials with them and just have one with each meal.
Okay.
But they'd be food poisoning and chronic stress would be the big two that I see where, you know, you can get a relapse or, you know, they just go nuts. They stop meal spacing. They start partying, eating badly.
Yeah.
Especially the younger ones. Yeah.
There's no surprise there. So in relation to the relapse prevention, meal spacing is number one. A prokinetic for a minimum of 3 months is number two. Number three is be proactive about stress management and treating stress. And then if they are traveling again, definitely take their Saccharomyces with them and potentially an antimicrobial depending on the case.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, the stress management, you know, the vagus nerve definitely plays a part in the gut as well.
Mm.
So stress plays a huge part. So yeah, you know, anything that's good for your vagal tone, so exercising, diaphragmatic breathing, you know, all those things that we should be doing,
yeah,
they're also going to help.
Amazing. Well, I've definitely got a little bit clearer on SIBO. It is such a complex condition that requires very careful assessment with a usually interprofessional team approach. I feel like this one does need a collective to treat, and that successful treatment must address the underlying drivers.
Yeah, so it's what I call, you know, a spectrum of chronicity. So for some people, it can be quite simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just do a short-term antimicrobial and they're kind of done, good to go. And then at the other end of the spectrum, it can be a really, really chronic condition. And you do need to be addressing all those different drivers. So I always view it more as a small intestinal dysfunction versus just the overgrowth. And I find looking at it that way, you tend to look at it more broadly and you're really focusing on improving the environment of the small intestine and making it, returning it to that homeostasis.
Mm.
Well, so that's covering all those bases: motility, digestive secretions, gut immunity, nervous system.
Amazing. Well, thank you for refreshing and updating our working knowledge on SIBO today, Matt.
You're welcome, Anne. Good to talk with you.
Good to speak to you too. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources from today's episode on their FX Medicine website. I'm Emma Sutherland, and thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.